Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the Lowy Institute. For those of us who are visiting us in our new premises for the first time, welcome to 1 Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove and I know many of the people in the room today, and it's a pleasure to see you all. Let me recognise a couple of people in particular. First of all, Mark Scott, Managing Director of the ABC. Thank you for joining us, Mark. And also, I can't see him now, right down here, the Assistant Shadow Treasurer, Andrew Lee, MP, who was a classmate of Justin's and mine at Sydney Uni and a classmate of Leon's at Harvard. So welcome, Andrew, and welcome warmly everybody else. Ladies and gentlemen, sometimes people think that the Lowy Institute is only about foreign policy and diplomacy, but of course, the single largest contributor to a nation's power and influence, as well as to the well-being of its citizens, is the strength of its economy. It's economic strength that lends our leaders prestige when they travel abroad. It's economic success that means we can afford the capacities we need. It's economic success that makes us more attractive as a country and makes other countries more willing to listen to us. So economic policy, of course, is absolutely critical for its own sake, but it's also, in a very practical sense, foreign policy. And that's one of the reasons why we're so committed to the International Economy Program at the Institute. The program provides analysis on a very wide range of economic issues and how they affect Australia. Many of you will have been here just a couple of weeks ago when we hosted David Dollar, a colleague of Justin's and mine at Brookings, as a visiting fellow to the G20 Study Centre to talk about the outlook for the Chinese economy and what that means for Australia and the wider region. There are few countries more critical to the international economy than the United States. That's why I'm delighted that today we're joined by economics power couple, Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson, to talk about the US presidential election, the US economy, economics in pop culture, and everything in between. Betsy, Justin, and I were just debating beforehand whether America this week reached peak crazy. I don't know if anybody saw Jeb Bush's tweet this morning. Jeb, of course, is the moderate establishment acceptable form of Republican, and he simply tweeted a picture of a Glock, I think, inscribed Governor Jeb Bush with the one word America. And it's a little scary for Americophiles like me that somebody who I think's instincts are pretty good, like Jeb Bush, would regard that image as really summing up the United States. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's the perfect time to hear from Betsy and Justin, and let me hand over to Leon Berkelmans, our Director of International Economics, to introduce them and chair the conversation. Leon.
Thank you very much, Michael. So I'm sure that we are all keen to hear what Betsy and Justin have to say, but I should point out a couple of select highlights from their CVs. So they are both professors at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, and right now are visiting Sydney University. Betsy was a member of Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and Chief Economist at the US Department of Labor. Justin worked at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he's a contributing columnist at the New York Times. They've both worked at Princeton, Wharton, and Justin's worked at Stanford. They are prolific media commentators and masters of social media. So let me start off by asking a question of Betsy. So for many things, economists have pretty clear policy proposals for many things. We think many things are good. So, for example, free trade, we think that that's a good thing. We think that things that impose external costs on others should be taxed. So pollution taxes are likely good things. And there are other various distortions that we think should be eliminated. So things like, I would argue, the farm bill in the US, we see that as bad policy. The subsidies there are bad policies. And when policies don't actually turn out the way that we think that they should turn out, we sort of shrug our shoulders and think, you know, politicians, you know, they're corrupt or stupid or something like that. No offense there, Andrew. But that's probably, given your experience working in the Obama administration, that's probably not a healthy attitude. So what is a good attitude? What is a healthy attitude for economists to have?
Great. Well, first of all, let me say that it's a pleasure to be here. And because this is Australia, let me just tell you a little bit what the Council of Economic Advisors is, because member of the Council of Economic Advisors is a very strange title. But the Council of Economic Advisors are three people who, obviously we have a staff below us, but who provide advice to the president on matters of economic policy. The two members are somebody who does micro advice and macro advice, and then a chair to keep us in line. So that's the structure, and I was a person who gave advice on the micro side, so mostly social policy. But your question is a great one, because we're coming in, traditionally the three people on the council come in from academia, and they are coming in maybe spending 2 years giving advice to the president and running a team of other academics who've come in for even less time, maybe a year, and trying to marshal what we know from academic research and turn that into advice that can actually be used as policy. And the most important thing to realize is that we're not starting from scratch with a whole new world. We are dealing with a system that already has a set of institutions in place and winners and losers from any kind of change. And so once you start to think about those winners and losers, what you need to be doing is thinking about incremental change. How can I make something a little bit better? Not how can I implement the perfect. The perfect is when you're building a brand new world. But now we're making change where we're going to generate winners and losers. And how can we make change that will, on net, be a positive benefit for everyone? And how do we deal with the competing forces that are going to come from the winners and losers? And the only way to be successful is to be genuinely excited about that. So a member on the macro side was Jim Stock, who's a former chair of the Harvard Econ Department. And you know, one day he came up to me extraordinarily excited because he said, "I moved them from 15th best policy to 14th. And you know, he really was thrilled that he'd been able to get something where he thought there was no chance we were ever going to do really good policy, but we could make it a little bit better. And he had won a big battle, and that big battle had been trying to get it from 15th to 14th. So you have to be thinking at the margin, and how can we incrementally get things better.
And can you say a few words about the role of evidence in the formulation of public policy? Economists, we sit down, we analyze data, we run regressions, we hope that this has some effect at some point in the chain. Are we all slaving away, sweating at the computer for no reason, or do we actually have some influence there?
Oh, I think that evidence-based policymaking is taking over around the world, but definitely in the United States. There's a real pressure for policy to be grounded in evidence. And the PhD students often come and spend a year working at the council. And I would joke with them, only somewhat teasingly, that what I would ask them to do in a month would have been a dissertation in my time period, in my youth. So we are asking them to bring up data, to come up with a plausible identification strategy and run counterfactuals and tell me, you know, if we raise the threshold underneath which people need to be paid overtime, if we raise it to $60,000 a year, what will happen compared to if we raise it to $50,000 a year? And they need to go off and they need to gather up the data and they need to say how many workers will likely get overtime pay, how many people will likely lose their job or lose hours, and come up with that analysis. And that informs the policymaking discussions. Discussions where you are bringing evidence to the table, you have more influence than when you don't have evidence. And the people who are the most influential are the people who've done their homework.
Even with the US Congress, even with some people there have very strong views that are very difficult to change. Even there, you think that evidence-based policy has some traction?
I think that not every member of Congress is interested in evidence, but some of them are obsessed by it. And to point across the aisle, Paul Ryan is obsessed with evidence-based policymaking and wants us to do more to make data accessible. That is a point of connection between him and many people on the Democratic side. And I hope when all the nonsense of primary season and election campaigning goes away that we can actually make some progress on that. Because there are people on both sides of the aisle that want to use more evidence to use evidence better.
So while we're on the subject of evidence, I think it would be fair to say that economists have had a little bit of a tough time with evidence over the last few years. There have been pretty well publicised examples where economists got things wrong. Possibly one of the most high profile ones in the last few years is the Reinhart-Rogoff issue. I know that there were issues of what they actually wrote down and how that was actually interpreted. There are other things. Steve Levitt's work had some errors in it, and that actually meant that some of the conclusions there weren't perhaps as strong as they otherwise were. You both have done work overturning a previously held accepted wisdom, which was the Easterlin paradox, where you came in, and I think my reading of it, Easterlin actually did not run the right tests. You guys came in, ran the right test with better data and overturned that paradox. So economists don't have, at the moment, I think they're having a little bit of trouble with this. How should policymakers therefore deal with the advice that economists give them if evidence is not exactly watertight?
So I think that there are some cases, and you just highlighted them, where we're going to see some errors. And there is some shopping that happens by politicians who are looking for research that will support a prior or a belief that they have. And when you have new evidence that is perhaps different from what people have known in the past, it's going to be seized on. As academics, what we typically think about is building a body of evidence with many, many papers, and that's what politicians should be relying on. So what we do know a lot about is returns to investing in early childhood education pay off. There is study after study after study, and that's the type of studies that politicians should be paying attention to, where we have a large body of evidence. We're not going to overturn the results and all of a sudden find out that investing in three-year-olds isn't important anymore. So the studies that they should be paying attention to are not a single one-off study, but a body of evidence that says this is a smart place for government to be intervening.
So Betsy's given the policymaker perspective. Let me give the economist's defense. Okay, we are imperfect. We make mistakes. Our models aren't true. We mess things up. We are politically compromised sometimes. Here's the defense. Everyone else is worse. At the end of the day, we are the least bad option. And on many of these things, so economics may be politicized, but you look at competing fields like sociology, you can figure out the conclusion of many of my friends in sociology before they put pen to paper. We make mistakes in data. We have data to start making mistakes in, and that's useful. So, I'm ready to get the bumper sticker out there. We're the least bad option, and we're the least bad by a reasonable enough margin that I don't think policymakers should be looking elsewhere.
I think just to add something to that, I mean, there are not as many economists involved in U.S. policymaking as I think would be a good idea. And one of the reasons why economists often step back in D.C. and let lawyers play economists, and if you look at many people who call themselves economists inside presidential administrations, they're actually trained lawyers, is because economists don't like to answer questions unless they're 100% certain of the answer. And as a result, they shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know. Well, somebody else is going to offer an answer. And so that's the Justin answer, which is, can you give an estimate that's better than the next guy? And that's what you have to be able to do in order to move the conversation forward, is put forward your best guess, even when the evidence isn't there. So, I sort of interpreted your question a little bit more narrowly, there are papers where we sort of get led down the wrong path.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. That's going to happen because of forum shopping. But it is also the case that you just have, policy is going to go forward whether there's good evidence or not. And so the best evidence that you can marshal is better than no evidence. And economists can sometimes be pretty reluctant to engage in that sort of really rough estimation. And they need to be able to do that in order to participate.
Even with the idea that you provide a point estimate, say you've got some estimate of the effect of a tax, but then there's going to be a wide confidence interval around that. You know, we would naturally put that confidence interval around that point estimate. But I would imagine that policymakers don't really get the nuance there, do they?
I think the answer is more nuanced than that, in the sense that some policymakers very much understand uncertainty very well, but uncertainty can be used against you in political debates. And so actually one of the, I can think back to my time arguing a particular policy issue, and the mistake I made was being too open about what my confidence interval was instead of just sticking on my point estimate, because you know, a political strategist who wanted to do something different than I wanted to do picked up the lower end of my point estimate and, you know, said, well, that's, you know, you can't say that you don't have this too, so let's just go with that.
So we have to be a little bit shrewd in how we present our results. Is that fair enough?
I think you need to know your audience.
Right. So Justin, you've done a lot of work on prediction markets. So I think you've co-authored with Andrew on some of this stuff. So the US presidential season, election season's in full swing. What have we learnt about this season from prediction markets? And also, what have we learnt about prediction markets from this season?
Yeah, so this season, I think you get a lot of clarity from watching the race through the lens of prediction markets. So, and I say this wearing now very much more my hat as a columnist, where, you know, I'm sometimes writing commentary on the race than as an economist. So, you know, you look at where one caucus and one primary in, and Hillary Clinton looks in terrible shape. You know, she just doesn't have a win. Doesn't matter. Prediction markets are absolutely clear, and they're exactly right. She will win the Democratic nomination. On the Republican side, none of us know what to make of Trump. Prediction markets give us a market-based assessment. And the views on Trump go from he's led every poll for 6 months to the political scientists telling us this is a standard part of any election cycle, that at some point we'll come to scrutinize the candidate. When we scrutinize him, we'll find he'll fall short. And they were totally certain. You know, Nate Silver wrote at some point that he thought Trump was only a 1% chance to win the nomination. That's clearly false too. So I think markets were faster than pundits to figure out Trump is real, and he is real. There's pretty much a 50% chance he wins the Republican nomination. And I do mean to freak you out. So, you know, they picked that up a little bit faster. They picked it up slower than the polls this time. You know, who knows which way that goes. The thing that's a little bit difficult is the US has an on-again, off-again relationship with gambling, which Australia does not. We embrace it, we love it, bet on two flies on a wall. And so actually we don't have strong, thick US prediction markets on this election. And the extent to which that changes things will be interesting, right? Because you've got a bunch of Europeans betting on the US. A bunch of Europeans understand US culture far less well. And so there's some reason to think that, you know, mistakes may end up being made. We'll find out.
Right. So to bring it back to your time in the Obama administration, Betsy, last year the economic report of the president got a lot of attention from a couple of facts that it highlighted. So the facts were the following. If productivity growth had not slowed after 1973, the median household would have $30,000 of additional income today. Fact number two, if income inequality had not increased after 1973, the median household would have $9,000 of additional income today. What's the policy lesson here? So we've got the productivity growth seems to be more important in a dollar sense here. But from my perspective, we know a lot less about how to deal with productivity growth and the slowdown and what caused it after 1973 than perhaps we know about the drivers of income inequality.
I agree. Now, there's a third thing that we pointed out, which was also labor force participation. And so I think to really understand the U.S. economy right now, it is important to realize that we have had basically middle-class wage stagnation since the end of the late 1990s, and that middle-class wage stagnation is coming from all three of these factors moving in the wrong direction. So in the 1960s and 1970s, as you noted, we had really strong productivity growth, tiny decrease in inequality and tiny increase in labor force participation, but we had robust wage gains coming from that robust productivity growth. That went away in the 70s and 80s, but in the early 90s, but women's growth in labor force participation was profound, and that drove increases in family incomes. So middle class, median family incomes went up during that period, mostly because of women's deepened participation and deepened earnings. So that was the driver. Now, in the U.S., women's labor force participation hit a ceiling in the late 90s and has been coming down. So we've got both of these things. We've got slowing productivity growth, we've got decreasing labor force participation, and then we've got rising inequality. All three of them are contributing to this middle class wage stagnation phenomenon that we're experiencing. And the point we were trying to make is everybody's hammering on the inequality side, but you've got to think about these other two levers as well. And in fact, progressives in the U.S., so this was a little cheeky of us as a Democratic administration's economic report of the president, progressives keep hammering on the fact that productivity growth is fine, it's just not returning gains to the middle class. And so we were like, it's not fine, actually. So that's also an issue. And there are some things that can be done. The U.S. is underinvesting in infrastructure. We should be investing appropriately in infrastructure. I can't tell you how much that will increase productivity growth, but certainly it's a reminder that there are things that we need to be doing. I agree with you that we do point to the hardest thing for policy to influence, but that doesn't mean that policymakers shouldn't be thinking about it. And I believe very strongly that President Obama should be aware that this is not just about redistribution, but it's also about making sure that we're investing in the economy in a way that would do as much as possible to facilitate more productivity growth.
Right. Let me ask you guys a joint question. So I think we have a gender issue in economics. I went to the American Economic Association meetings in January in San Francisco. I caught up with you both there. I went to, I think, 8 panel discussions. 7 of those were all male. 7. In 2016, that seems very odd. Why does economics seem to have this gender problem?
You want me to go first?
Sure.
I didn't want to be the pushy bloke who was going to talk at the top of the world. This is actually something I've been writing about and thinking about a lot. So first thing, I want to congratulate you on the question. Economists don't talk about the problem, and that's the first problem, right? There's no way that we can repair the profession unless we're willing to acknowledge the problem. I actually serve on the committee for the status of women in the economics profession, which is more or less, they have a token bloke who's there, I'm the token bloke, and we collect statistics and trying to move the profession in the right direction. So with many of these gender things in many fields, everyone just says, be patient, these things take time, there weren't many women going to uni 40 years ago, of course the profession's male dominated. That excuse doesn't fly anymore. And it actually turns out if you look at the top 20 PhD granting institutions in the US, the proportion female among their graduate students hasn't grown in 15 years. So there's this long-term problem, which is we have a lot of women start Economics 1. We have fewer do Economics 2. We have fewer end up as majors. We have fewer, and they're dropping out at every point. We have fewer who then go on to professional jobs as economists. We have fewer who go on to graduate school. We have fewer who finish graduate school. We have fewer who become assistants. Like, every stage of the pipeline, there's leakage. Part of it's cultural. And Betsy, I'm sure, can speak about her own personal experiences. But, you were struck about walking into a room and seeing only blokes on stage. Imagine walking into a room and being the total outsider. And that's what lots of rooms in economics look like. There are some fields that are worse than others. There's macroeconomics is frankly a disaster. and the field should be ashamed of itself. You know, and the problems here range from very simple 1950s style discrimination. You know, you just had a baby, we're going to put you on mum track for a while. Outrageous sexual harassment that literally occurs and no one's willing to talk about it, no one's willing to call it out. To, there's a piece I wrote in the Times the other day, wonderful piece of research by a young Harvard graduate student in which she looked at the career progress of male and female economists. Turns out the more papers you write, the more likely you are to get promoted, unless you're a woman who writes those papers with men. Because as soon as you see a Betsy and Justin paper, it turns out what you do is you infer that Justin wrote the paper and I don't know.
I cooked his dinner while he was doing right. it.
Betsy rarely cooks. And so, you know, that's a more subtle institutional, it's a more subtle form of discrimination. And I suspect that people doing it don't realize they're doing it. But it's there and it's very real. And so, you know, there are occupations where you can actually change, you become aware of the bias and you try and fight against it. So one of my favorite economics papers is by Claudia Goldman and C.C. Rouse. Several of the symphonies, used to be that if you wanted to try for a symphony, you'd walk in, you'd play your violin, and they'd say, oh, that was good, that was bad. They had the bright idea that what they'd do is they'd put up a black curtain between the judges and the musicians. And when they did that, all of a sudden they started picking female musicians, right? So a lot of what we do in the labour market is actually pulling back that curtain. The way we interview for jobs, I don't know how you do it here at Lowy, we take young PhD students, we put them in a room for 30 minutes, and we ask them to tell us to make their pitch. This is the perfect institution for helping overconfident white men like myself. And it's been wonderful for me, but I suspect that's part of the problem. And so, you know, we've got to think about how we can create institutions that de-bias someone.
I think, you know, what I would add to that is people want to think that we're a very objective field and that it's, you know, all just objectively on the merits. But there is a lot of subjectivity. And I think that when people were picking violinists for orchestras, they really thought it was very objective and they're just looking for the best music. And if that was true, why would the black curtain have actually mattered? In many other fields, people have come to accept that. They've come to accept that even though I truly believe I'm listening just to hear the best musician, I have these biases and I have to try to overcome them. Economists are really, really reluctant to admit that. They cling to this idea that everything we do is so objective that there's no reason they should have to de-bias because their biases are, you know, part of the, like, you know, efficient market. And that, I think that is part of the challenge that is faced. And I can tell you that as, you know, the most striking thing for me is just the different feel of walking in to the White House and operating in an environment like that versus operating in an econ department. And they're really, I mean, you have incredibly talented people in the White House. And yet, the openness, the willingness that everybody around the table has to the idea that if you're not saying something that they think is smart, maybe they're not hearing you correctly, or maybe they need to. There's a deference where people are really trying to understand each other and trying to overcome their biases. And I saw that among some of the most masculine foreign policy people, which that's a pretty masculine-ish crowd. Even everybody's trying because they have become aware of these biases, and we've got to somehow. And this is where it comes back to Justin's first point: we got to acknowledge the problem.
So Justin mentioned institutional changes. Now the black curtain probably wouldn't work in those 30-minute sessions. Probably might have helped me a little bit back into the day because when I went through that process, one of my interviewers actually fell asleep, and I wouldn't have noticed that. So that probably would have been helpful for me. And perhaps we could institute rules like no all-male panels. But are there any other more concrete things that we can do apart from acknowledging the problem?
So I just wanted to give you one, I don't know if it's a statistic or a story. There's exactly one leading economics department that has ever hired three female macroeconomists. It's UC Berkeley. Those three women were Laura Tyson, who was President Clinton's chief economic advisor, Kristi Romer, who was President Obama's chief economic advisor, and Janet Yellen, who runs the world. So hiring three female macroeconomists turned out to be a pretty darn good bet. So there's some, you know, there's some sort of payoff to doing this. You know, what else should we be doing?
But the question is the payoff to who? Like, is that something the economics department is excited about, or is that something that the dean is excited about, or is that something that the university president is excited about? I mean, I think that this is, at the tops of universities, people understand this problem. I worked with the deans of leading business schools in the United States while I was in the administration, in the Obama administration, to just come up with a set of best practices for doing more to build women in business careers. And we talked about how difficult it was for them working with their faculty, who felt like they were being asked to lower their standards by doing things that might make business careers more appealing for women. And we weren't talking about lowering standards. We were trying to identify why is it, you know, MBA programs in the United States have declining enrollment. They actually want to solve this gender problem just from a you know, increased applications sense. But it's in the, you know, the tops of the universities understand it, and they understand it not as a touchy-feely thing, but like as a moving into the next century thing. But they really struggle with their faculty, and I think that's the same thing when it comes to economics departments. You know, it's the nature of the academic system that we don't really force academics who don't move into leadership positions to question the status quo.
Leon, let me just tell you this a little experiment we ran. So I was editor of the Brookings Papers on economics for several years. My co-editor, David Romer, was also partnered with a female economist. He's Kristi Romer's husband. And we decided that what we try and do is not have all male panels. And so as we're putting our panels together, we put a thumb on the scale, what we thought was a thumb on the scale, to try and get a little bit more balance. It's actually very difficult. There's not a lot of female economists. So then we felt we were putting a fist on the scale. So you might call this affirmative action. We felt a little uncomfortable about whether that was or wasn't. And it turns out it wasn't, because at the end of every conference, we'd still discover that the women who'd spoken, on average, were higher quality than the men. So we thought we were putting a fist on the scale. Turns out we should have been putting our whole arm on. And so, you know, again, this is a case of actually doing the right thing. Actually turns out to yield a better conference. And we, trying as hard as we could to be progressive, didn't go anywhere near far enough.
So, Justin, there's economists coming of age at the moment in the time of blogs and podcasts, something that we didn't really have, I guess, when we were coming of age of economists. How do you think that this is affecting the field of economics, and especially those people coming through graduate programs? Are they better prepared? Are they going to be better economists because of this, for reading your blog posts and podcasts and things like that?
Every time I get called the 140-character economist, I feel that's not a compliment. You know, here's the exciting thing. Economics is in the public sphere. And we have the capacity to get people excited about what we do. I'm an economist because I think we can make the world a better place. I am an economist because I think she's the queen of the social sciences. I think we have insights that we can offer on everything from whether to cut interest rates to how to make family life deliver better for more people. And so if we can be out there getting more people excited, and it's a little bit, there's a different story in the US than in Australia, actually. In the US, economics really is an incredibly popular major. We are, at Michigan, we're turning away students. They're queuing up to be allowed to take first year economics. In Australia, there's, you know, students seem to be somewhat more vocationally minded, so there's the competition from business rather than economics. The US, we don't have many business majors as undergraduates. We just sort of don't allow them. Tell them if you want to do that, wait for your MBA. But, you know, it's got to be attracting more people. And if they're people who are attracted because they think that these issues are interesting and exciting, I want to welcome them with open arms. Some of my colleagues might say, well, if they're attracted because the issues are interesting and exciting rather than because they're really good at math, maybe we're going to get a whole bunch of people who aren't really good at maths. I don't get this stuff. So What I'd like to see more of, you know, Jess Irvine's here. Jess is one of the best economics columnists in Australia. But I'd like to see the non-economics columnists understanding and talking and using our language a little more. We shouldn't be a subspecialty or a subfield. It's a simple language for understanding social phenomena. It shouldn't be one little bureau at the newspaper. It should be transfused throughout the policy process. And so maybe we are educating the next generation a little bit there, and that's a helpful thing.
So you spoke about how economics might be viewed as a bit of a field by itself, but even within economics itself, you have tribes, you have clans. So, Betsy, you've worked in the private sector and in government and in academia. Justin, you were in think tank for a time. You work in academia. I get the feeling that people in those various clans sometimes talk with a bit of derision about the other people in those camps, right? So you might find government economists, tut tut, academics, and say, oh, they're just doing this esoteric stuff. It doesn't really matter. It's navel gazing. You might have the academics shaking their head and saying, oh, these government economists or in the private sector, these guys just aren't rigorous. Well, quite frankly, they're not as smart as us. You get that. That's, I don't think, healthy. I've seen examples where I don't think that is healthy. Are there ways that we can break that down?
Yeah, so I think you're describing Australia. I don't think you're describing the rest of the world. I think you're describing a weakness in Australia. So my thesis advisor, Olivier Blanchard, I think is surely the best macroeconomist in the world. Olivier taught me when he was at MIT. He then went off to become chief economist of the IMF. Larry Katz was my other advisor. Larry spent much of his career at Harvard. He was chief economist at Labor many years before Betsy was. And he's on a plane every other weekend to Washington to talk to various kinds of policymakers. No one has ever said that Larry's a worse economist for doing that or Olivier's a worse economist for doing that. Betsy's career has been academia, government, academia. And so, the biggest problem that Australian economics faces is we're a small country, so we've got a small talent pool. And so the single dumbest thing we could do is take that small talent pool and put it in three separate silos and have those three separate silos never talk. It's what we do. And we don't have academics moving back and forth between policy. The one exception is Andrew Lee right here. Andrew was an academic. He spent time at Treasury, and now he's our next great hope. For someone in Parliament to think something sensible. But Andrew's the exception, not the rule. And what I desperately hope for is we have more Andrew Lees. That requires a cultural change. Many in the bureaucracy, they do. They're like, oh, we're all so freaking smart, we don't need to listen to anyone else. Many within academia are like, oh, they're just bureaucrats, why would I need to talk to them? And think tanks are small and new in Australia. And so I'd like to see just a lot more interchange. And that's, as I've been talking to different people while we've been in Australia, I've been sort of pounding the table on this. And the thing I've learned is when I do this, I just sound like a crazy American. but I don't think I'm wrong.
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of respect across groups in the U.S. I mean, one of the things the Council of Economic Advisors does is tries to pull in information from academia to feed into the policy process. And when I picked up the phone...
Australia doesn't have that channel.
Mm-hmm. When I picked up the phone, economists, very high caliber economists, very busy economists, would stop and talk to me. David Labson, there was a policy issue I was working on that was more in his space than mine, read a 30-page document for me and spent 2 hours on the phone going through and telling me how to make it better. People in academia have a lot of time for people in government. People inside government have an enormous respect for people in academia. And within the think tanks, they're in and out of government and pulling in academics all the time. President Obama liked to meet with academic economists, and we would set up meetings, and I can tell you when most academic economists are called and said, you know, would you like to take an hour meeting with the President of the United States? They are pretty excited by that option, opportunity. They rarely think that's a bad idea. So, you know, there's just this engagement, and I found, you know, just enormous respect for people that I found that people mostly had enormous respect for what everybody was doing.
Let me tell you the payoff from this. The world, you know, the U.S. economy cratered in 2008. You know, we were really in crisis. If you could sit down and write a sketch of who it is you would want to run the central bank at a moment like that, it would be Ben Bernanke. It would be someone who'd studied the Depression deeply, someone who's the greatest, you know, the finest monetary economist of his generation. It would be someone with the perfect temperament for the job. And so Ben Bernanke chairs, you know, was chairing the Fed through that period. I'm not confident that the next RBA governor will be the Australian Ben Bernanke. And that's partly because we're shrinking the pool of folks we're willing to look at. And I think that's a huge payoff for the US that they were able to have someone of Ben's caliber at that moment. And that payoff is frankly worth trillions of dollars.
Okay, so we are, I can't believe the time is going so quickly. I just looked at my watch and realized I'd already gone over the time I'd allotted myself. We are going to have questions very soon. So get them ready. What we're going to do right now is play a little game while you're thinking. It's a game I'm stealing from some of Tyler Cowen's podcasts, which is called Underrated or Overrated. I'm going to throw a few things at Justin and Betsy, names of places, things or something like that, and they're going to tell me whether it's overrated, underrated or fairly valued.
So all the nuance you expect from an economist.
Yeah, exactly. Quite right. So I would ask you to tell me what you think and a very brief explanation of why, if you want to throw that in. So, first of all, Australia.
Underrated.
Underrated.
Okay. Harvard.
Underrated.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
I would
just
say...
This is where we met.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Just while you're thinking.
Good point.
You know, I would either say fairly rated or underrated. You know, and I actually give you some background, which is, you know, in economics, one of the journals, the Quarterly Journal of Economics, everybody complains that if you get a PhD from Harvard, you get a free pass, you get to publish something in the QJE. And the analysis of that has shown that when Harvard students publish in the QJE, they get more citations than others. So perhaps they are underplaced there.
Says the woman who published her thesis in the QJE.
All right. Yeah, I didn't get that, but in any case. Wall Street.
Overrated.
Overrated.
All right. Donald Trump.
You're not even going to make this hard, are you, mate? Overrated.
Underrated. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take questions. I would ask that you identify yourself and the organization that you come from. Good questions have a couple of characteristics, I find. They are short and end with a question mark. So if you could follow those rules, that would be wonderful. We have a roving mic, so wait until you get that. Until you ask your question, we have a very eager individual down at the front row. So there we go.
I'll be short and eager.
Okay, wonderful.
Tim Harcourt, the airport economist from the University of New South Wales. A quick question about gender. I think I've been to 58 countries in the last 5 years, and in India, Malaysia, Mongolia, Latin America, I meet a lot of women economists in college, in boardrooms, in the central bank. Do you think these skew against women is an Australian or American phenomena that you may not find in Asia, Latin America, Africa, and so on?
There's a reason you're the airport economist, Tim, and I'm not. I've not been there, so I have no idea.
What we do know is that women around the world are going to uni more than men, and they're overtaking many fields, and it's actually a puzzle that at the uni level in the U.S., they're at parity, but that's actually disproportionately low given that 60% of college students or uni students in the U.S. are women, so that they're only, you know, 58%-ish of econ students is low. But, you know, that's the sense in which you should continue to see a march. We just come back to this issue that Justin raised about the top PhD programs are not increasing the number of women.
Hi, Nikki Hutley from Urbis. You mentioned earlier about incremental policy being perhaps the best outcome. In Australia, we're now starting to re-debate once more tax reform. You've probably seen the headlines in the last couple of weeks, couple of things off the table, sales tax, but now we're looking at negative gearing is on there. Mm-hmm. Do you have any views? Are you familiar with our tax system? And what would you recommend as the best incremental change that we could possibly make? What would you recommend to our Prime Minister or the opposition?
So I don't know much about this, so I'll let Justin think for a minute in case he wants to say something. But what I will say is that I have been seeing, you can't miss the headlines on and the reporting on negative gearing. And the thing that is most striking to me is that you are starting from a place where there are a bunch of winners from the current system who could become losers, and that is going to change what you're going to be able to do, which is very different from the U.S. We don't have that system. We're not aching to get it. We're not aching to get it because we don't have it. And that's the sense in which status quo creates an enormous bias. And you've got to, you're going to be making incremental changes from your status quo.
Two observations. So the Labor Party has just announced, their new approach to negative gearing. One of the things that's interesting about it is it grandfathers everyone in. That's incrementalism. Right. It's not clear that everyone who bought a second and third house and is enjoying big tax breaks necessarily should be getting it. It's just politically saleable. So, we see incrementalism at work. The other is, there's just been a debate about the change in the tax mix, indirect versus direct, consumption versus income tax. The way this is often described is you want to broaden the base to lower the rates. A mistake that lots of people make is they say, well, if we lower the rates, that must mean that there's a greater incentive to work. There's not. We're just relocating the disincentive, right? So if what we're doing is we're no longer taking it out of your income, but the groceries are now more expensive, the disincentive to earn the extra dollars is still there. And so that's why it's never a surprise when someone looks at these lower the rates, broaden the base things, if they do it in a moderately honest way, it's never a surprise that the effects of that, the economic effects, just don't turn out to be miraculous.
Thank you. Judy Betts from UTS. The global economy at the moment is very volatile, and people are looking at China and worried about what that impact might be on the global for the global economy. If we were to, for example, have a second GFC, are you convinced that the people in leadership positions in the US are wise enough to negotiate the US and by flow on everybody else through that rocky time? And are you convinced that we have enough actual instruments, economic instruments, to be able to manage a second GFC, given there's so much money in the economy at the moment?
So, from the US perspective, I mean, obviously there's a lot of risk, and for US, the current U.S. economy, the biggest risk we face is what's going on in the rest of the world. If you look at U.S. GDP growth, it's really, net exports has been subtracting pretty consistently now for the past year. And so there's real concern about what's going to happen in the rest of the world. I do think we've learned some lessons from the last, from the last crisis. And one would hope that those lessons will persist. And we're obviously seeing several central banks right now experiencing or experimenting with what happens when we don't have, zero is not a lower bound anymore, but rates go negative. And so we're learning some more lessons from that. I'm not one who really likes to forecast because, I think it's really hard to do. So will we manage it correctly? I will tell you that I think the people whose job it is to manage through that are very smart, very experienced, and are certainly paying a lot of attention to what's going on. So they're not going to be blindsided or surprised by it. And one hopes that's enough. But of course, you can never tell.
So I think Betsy makes the mistake here of having worked in the executive branch. And so she's thinking about the executive branch. So we agree on almost nothing. So, you know, do I think the Fed is likely to be, I think, well-positioned? The big mistake that was made in the U.S. was the U.S. Congress refused to be active on fiscal policy. No lesson has been learned there. They'll continue to be inactive, and we've got rates very close to zero. What about Australia? I remember walking through the Brookings cafeteria and finding a bereft Wayne Swan, who was sort of confused because he'd managed an active fiscal policy in Australia, and he'd avoided a recession, and he was no longer a minister. So maybe the Australian public were the ones who've now set up an odd set of incentives for the next time we have this sort of a thing. You know, it was relative to any other country, Australia managed the period perfectly, and it was surprising that we're one of the only country that we kicked the bums out, where elsewhere there were mistakes made and people stayed.
So, Peter Tulip, Reserve Bank of Australia. I wanted just to follow up on your previous comments there, and they tied in very much with Leon's first question about the gap between expert opinion and policy outcomes. And fiscal policy seems to be one of the most important of these gaps, where mainstream economics would suggest at the zero bound you have stimulatory fiscal policy. But in fact, in the United States, the UK, Europe, they're going the opposite direction. Why is that, and what's the constraint? Is it, and how do you address it? Is it public opinion, in which case we might want to write op-eds in the New York Times? Is it legislative opinion, in which case we might want to do wonky reports by the CEA? Or is it just the academic consensus is too weak to support a clear policy recommendation?
It's a great question, Peter. So I think there's a clear academic consensus. Active fiscal policy can help. Of course, you can find some clown who'll say something otherwise. But if you look at actual surveys of large numbers of economists, and University of Chicago runs one of these, there's no question that there's a consensus that an active fiscal policy can be helpful. So, you know, the profession understands this. The electorate in the US is angry about something. And so I think that's the profession's fault, that we've learned something, and we've failed to convince the public of that. In Australia, we have been historically very well served by very good economics journalists who've done a good job of keeping public opinion close to expert opinion. And I think preserving that tradition is really, really important for Australia's future. If economics journalists weren't writing what they were writing, Wayne Swan wouldn't have been able to get the fiscal package passed that he did, and we would have been in recession. So in this story, the heroes are the economics journalists. And we should praise them for that, and we should make sure there's a really good next generation of them coming through. And then the failures in the US is a failure of the profession to connect with the general public. We've failed in many, many different ways. I don't know if we need to write more New York Times op-eds, whether we need to do a better job teaching Econ 101, whether there are problems with the political structure over there where, you know, again, you can get 100 economists in a room, 98 of them say it's a good idea, two don't. And Fox News will put talking heads arguing. Actually, so will CNN, right? And there are professional consensuses over some things. We've got to communicate that consensus more effectively.
So I actually want to disagree a little bit with the premise of the question, because if you look at the United States, you know, at the time that in 2009, when they were looking to pass stimulative fiscal policy, no one knew how bad the downturn was. Go and look at what the estimates of GDP were and the decline in GDP were back at the time they were passing the policy. We just didn't know how bad it was. I mean, this is why Christy Romer got criticized by saying, if we pass this stimulus, this is what unemployment will look like. And of course, unemployment went well above what she said it would happen if we didn't pass the stimulus. And that's because, and you can go and look at where other economists were forecasting unemployment at that time. No one knew how bad things were. So we did pass, you know, a stimulus bill, we went on to pass, you know, 2 years later, another tax cut, the payroll tax cut, to put more money in people's pockets. There was, you know, sort of continued efforts. And now the U.S. is at 4.9% unemployment. And so, you know, the Democrats did disagree with, you know, I think it was a failure of politics. It wasn't a failure of people not understanding the benefits of fiscal policy. There was a brinkmanship that happened around budget negotiations. And in that brinkmanship, at the time that they passed the sequester, they thought that this would actually constrain them. Like, you know, if we both are going to go down, then none of us will want us to go down, right? So they said, we're going to get these big cuts to both domestic spending and to defense spending, and then that will make us come to the bargaining table and come up with a sensible policy. And then they didn't, right? They were willing to go over, you know, the cliff, and I think they didn't understand how bad their relationships were, that they were going to continue to get worse. So nobody intended for that to happen. It wasn't about a lack of knowledge. It wasn't that they didn't understand that the sequester was a bad idea. It was a failure. Just like the government shutdown in 2013 was a failure. It was a failure of brinksmanship. So I think, you know, and if you look even just this past year, you know, the budget negotiations went well. Their spending, you know, they undid much of the sequester, and big tax cuts were passed at the end of the year. So I think that there is knowledge about the fiscal side, but you know, it does require, particularly in divided government the way we have in the US, being able to come together and negotiate.
Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately that ends the conversation event. I hope you all enjoyed it. Join me in thanking Justin and Betsy, and hope to see you here again soon.